Welcome to episode 6 of the Donnybrook Podcast. I'm your host, David.
I'm Amanda.
And John.
Wahoo! Here we are.
So this last week, David and I got to hang out extra time, spend extra time together because David's house was being torn apart again. He's been remodeling. I want you to tell some stories.
Oh my goodness.
It's been a disaster after disaster.
We've just been remodeling this house since May, and this is September, so it's been like a pretty 4.5
months. It's an addition. It's a full remodel. It's not just a...
Yeah, we added a couple of rooms. We blew out the living room, made that a little bigger. Had to redo all the paint, all the carpet, all the wood floor. Just, oh my goodness. So for a while, you know, it was great because everything was outside. And then, you know, wow, okay, now we have to redo the paint and we have to just totally get out of the house. And we were out of the house and we were living actually at the church. We were kind of homeless for 3 weeks. So that was fun.
Well, and then Boise is going through this like this growth phase again where everybody, it seems like, in the world is moving here. And it's on every list of top 5 places to live in the United States or whatever. So subcontractors are impossible to find. Contractors are super busy. Everybody's building new homes. So didn't that contribute some to your...
Yeah, I think, you know, who wants this little project where you got to go in and, you know, do... 2 rooms of sheetrock when you got a whole house you can do. That's much better money and much quicker, right?
So in addition to the contracting issue, we also have David doesn't have a lot of room in his life for disruption, being self-employed, having how many children now?
Oh my goodness.
17, 18?
It's innumerable.
Innumerable.
So I've been so
full quiver,
not giving, not having very much.
David, what do you think about full quiver
space in my life?
For opinions about full quivers,
he's ignoring me. Okay, keep going.
I've just
rolling. Good job.
Been so much not having lots of talking about things because I'm thinking about what John just said.
you told me last week that you were. Like every available moment you were thinking about, how do I get, you know, the flooring contractor to come back? I mean, we have to get the
right.
Carpet, like
yeah.
The carpet.
Totally. I feel like I'm the general contractor on this project. But
which is not a sign that you have a good general contractor, just
that,
FYI.
That's a very good point. Yes, if anyone's looking for a recommendation, I don't have one. So, anyway, you know, something I'd noticed that was really interesting is that these contractors would come in and they would be so irritated. Like the subcontractors, they come in, they'd just be, you know, just frustrated and mad and worked up and just upset. And I found that I would just talk to them, I'd introduce myself and just try to be as friendly as I could. And
we know that's difficult for you, David. You're just not a very approachable kind of guy.
I've kind of got that golden retriever personality, I guess, hopefully. But, and I found that after a while, they would settle down and we'd have some great conversations and really some good opportunities to work. You know, I guess not working together because I wasn't actually working there, but they ended having a positive experience and it being a positive thing. And I kept thinking, why can't the contractor treat them better? I mean, I guess he knows his business, but boy, he's coming into this and they're so grumpy and cranky because of how they're being treated and being pushed around. And all it takes is just a little bit of kindness and a little bit of thoughtfulness and let's be nice and you have much better relationship and experience with people. So, gee, ugh.
So that reminds me of the quote that you sent to us earlier in this week from...
Ooh, yeah, that was a good one. Let me
think of
that.
Was it Letters to Malcolm by,
yeah.
by Lewis? And it was about... Like, I think this kind of summed up my thoughts of why we chose the name Donnybrook for the podcast. Like, why do we make having discussions or disagreements or fights over like the gray areas or the perceived, the difficult things to talk about? Why are we making that kind of a centerpiece of our, of our conversation.
Yeah, like, what, totally. He says, quote? Yeah. I found it here. In Letters to Malcolm, Lewis writes, "Nothing makes an absent friend so present as a disagreement." And so the guy, I found this on a Lewis group on Facebook, and he says, out of context, it could be seen as Lewis suggesting that the sense of a friend's presence is a negative feeling because of the disagreement. But in fact, Lewis loved disagreements and the arguments. Mm-hmm. He believed friends could so be drawn close together. I think it was as about as convincing. It was about as much convincing the other as it was about challenging each other to open and exercise their minds.
Yeah.
So in today's society, if we lost the ability to seriously disagree on something and still maintain great friendships, or could an argumentative group like the Inklings exist today? Probably not online, but I don't know. What do you guys think? I mean, I guess that's kind of what we're after here, right?
Yeah, I think we are after that. And I think that, well, I mean, if we're podcasting now, what is this, our sixth episode? Wow, that's getting high up there in numbers. But we've been talking and arguing and disagreeing back and forth. Well, I've known you guys for, I don't know, 12, 13 years. And you guys have known each other much longer than that. And if as strongly opinionated a group as we are, and the sheer number of arguments and discussions and debates that we've had, that I know, I totally agree that that has brought us closer together. And I don't know, cliche, but a good cliche.
Well, it made us better thinkers too. I think it's definitely, I mean, again, cliche, but iron sharpening iron.
Yeah.
I've come away from conversations and I've not changed a particular position, but I've thought, I just argued that so poorly. I didn't convince myself with my own argument, you know, and that's important. And then the other piece of it is, a lot of times I come away from a conversation like these and I go, okay, I trust Amanda. I trust David. I disagree with them, but I know that their heart is to follow Jesus.
Right.
Their heart is to give glory and honor and praise to the King. And so I can trust that as they're embarking on that journey, we may come at it from different angles. Mm-hmm. We may even arrive at different conclusions, but if we're working towards that same ultimate objective, there's something to be gained from the voice that they're giving to this argument. And in the age that we're in, where everything is getting polarized into blacks mm-hmm. and whites, and it feels like you can't get onto Facebook without somebody taking a definitive political position definitive.
How do you feel about the national anthem, John?
Right. I don't even want to talk about it because neither side is really listening to the other, and there is very little. Let's throw up a meme of somebody kneeling and say something disparaging, or let's throw up a meme of
Absolutely.
Just
it's not forwarding any arguments. It's just, it's not.
There are walls everywhere.
Yeah. Walls. That's a great way to put it.
Stonewalling each other.
Is it a great wall?
Is it
a beautiful wall?
It's huge.
It's a huge wall.
Yeah. But that idea that disagreement or conflict primarily brings division is antithetical to Christian community.
Well, not if the goal is to polarize.
Well, yeah.
And we live in an age where the goal
that is the goal.
Yeah, that's the ultimate goal.
So what makes the difference for me? Because I have been embroiled in a number of conflicts in my lifetime, some of which were fairly divisive. The thing that works for me in a friendship in an argument context like this, like Donnybrooking, either on a podcast or off, is that fundamental trust and affection. I don't know. I think a lot about Lewis's categories of love, that friendship, the love of friendship, that I know when we're in conflict, we're not in conflict for ego or for dominance.
It's not a personal thing.
Well, I don't know if personal or not personal. I think I know what you're saying. Like, you're not disagreeing with me to get at me.
Yeah.
That it's not personal in that way, but it is personal in the way, in the sense that, even in the midst of disagreeing about whatever it is. And I remember.
Yeah. It's personal because we care.
Right.
It's personal because we're not just saying it because we want to argue for the sake of argument, but we're saying, wait, this is really important. And
if you think that, I think you've got a disconnect, and let's explore that and see if that's really what we're thinking.
Right. Or I might, and let's actually sort through the argument and figure out where the weak points are. Where's the evidence that we need? Where's the better, tighter logical structure? Where's the better reasoning? And where is the space to just disagree while maintaining that fundamental,
So, friendship. I mean, this reminds me of a situation when I was in college, I think, and this was like when the Young, Restless, and Reform movement was starting to really get its teeth, and everybody in that who was part of that movement had to like grow a beard and look like a lumberjack and drink beer. Okay. And I went over to one of these guys' house, and he offered me a beer. And it was very clear to me that because I didn't drink the beer with him, that I was like some kind of a weaker Christian.
Right.
And I thought, okay, this, like, you have missed the point of the whole exploration of your freedom. And like, if you're using this to put somebody else down, you've defeated the whole purpose of the conversation. We're not having a conversation. We're just categorizing each other.
Right.
And that is the problem. When we start slapping terms onto our, and the thing I'm wrestling with right now is slapping terms onto ourself.
Right.
Because a lot of times people slap terms on each other. Oh, that person's just a liberal or a conservative, or that person's just they're always going to think that way. But what I'm starting to wrestle with a little bit is, what terms do I identify myself with? Mm-hmm. And are those terms helpful, mm-hmm. or are they divisive? And in a world where everything is pushed to the polarized extreme, I feel like we need more arguments and less labels. And I haven't thought through this very well, so I may retract that at some point, but that's what I'm wrestling with.
Can we have a t-shirt for that? More arguments, less labels?
I can't imagine that ever being misunderstood. When you're talking about that, I've been thinking about some of the things I've wrestled with just over the years. The maybe infantile desire to have people in these are good people, those are bad people categories. These are safe people, those are not safe people. The difficulty, of course, coming when someone who you otherwise have thought of as being a good person or a safe person expresses an opinion that you disagree with. And
what means they're a bad
the
person.
Cognitive dissonance that comes with that.
Right.
Like I've trusted them, but here I disagree with them. And the challenge of maturity of being able to know people in a complex way without having to reject them because of one characteristic or because of one disagreement, or not accepting the things that you disagree with because you've accepted the person and now you have to accept all of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that ties in there with the labeling people. If I have the right labels attached to me, then I'm acceptable to this group of people. Mm-hmm. And if I attach them in the right way, then I'll be protected.
Right.
Speaking of labels, I actually started a really great book. I haven't finished it yet, so I can't give you the definitive word on it, but it started out really, really well. A friend of mine from work handed it to me unprompted. I can't imagine why she thought I would enjoy it. But it's called,
I think this is going to be good.
It's probably good. It's called Neither Complementarian Nor Egalitarian, by Michelle Lee Barnwell, Barnwall.
Well, it's written by a woman, so clearly it's got a bias.
Clearly.
Right.
Well, actually, at this point, I don't know anything about the author or what her conclusions on
she's a woman.
Gender roles or authority are. You're hilarious. but also kind of a punk.
remember when I was kidding around about starting a Twitter handle called Failed Patriarchy Club?
Yes, I remember
that.
I started it
and then I never tweeted a thing. But I have it. It's in my Twitter.
Failed Patriarchs?
Buried somewhere. At Failed Patriarchy Club. You guys can be my first two followers.
So I think why she thought I'd enjoy it. And it was written by a woman and recommended by a woman to a woman. So clearly we're being very exclusive here. The preface lays out her intent in the book, and that is to examine the ways that the gender debate in the evangelical world has been shaped by the secular concerns of society at that time. So that the debate about women's roles in the Victorian era was very much shaped by Victorian society as a whole and not primarily by theology. And then the debate over gender roles in the 50s and 60s was very much shaped by the concerns of secular society and not by theological concerns. And that our current debate is in the same way being shaped by secular social concerns. And so by examining that historical context, she says she doesn't actually take a position on roles in the church or roles in marriage, but that what she's trying to do is clear the ground to start discussing, gender roles in the church based solely in the theology and not in the prevailing social concerns.
So what does she talk about as one of the current prevailing social concerns?
I haven't gotten to that chapter yet.
You haven't gotten to that chapter yet?
I haven't gotten to that chapter yet.
Okay, so have she just kind of unpacked like the Victorian era and then the
Victorian era and then
the hippie era.
The post-World War II era. Okay. And the second wave feminism.
Okay.
So she's...
And second wave feminism, help me with the definition of...
Okay, so first wave feminism is women's Christian temperance union, right. And women should vote.
Women should vote, right.
Which we gained the right to do in the 1920s.
Right,
and
after
that,
blacks.
Yes, that's true. Movement started before the Civil War, but really never took off until it stopped talking about women's rights and started talking about women's responsibilities, which is really interesting.
Right.
Their responsibility to influence society.
You know, that the only time, even like thinking back to pop culture references to the women's temperance movement, like they're mostly caricatures.
Oh, absolutely.
Like the mom in Mary Poppins, mm-hmm. who's just a dumb blonde. Like she plays she's very much a caricature of all thing. Anyway, please continue.
Oh, okay. So that's
first wave.
That's first wave feminism.
Second
wave is Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique. You have loaded these housekeeping, homemaking, subordinating her desires to her husband, concerns onto women, and far from being satisfied, women are discontent and overdrugged. Which there was, at least among middle-class white women in America during that time, there was pretty heavy prescription drug use, pretty frequent diagnoses of neuroses, heavy alcohol use, and lots of other issues going on. So that's second-wave feminism. We're all very familiar with third-wave feminism, which is you can be whatever you want to be and marry whoever you want and definitions apply to no one, and all choices are empowered choices, whether you're a stripper or mm-hmm. a politician.
Right,
So those are the waves.
Those are the waves. Okay, so what have you read in the book again?
I'm so
unaccustomed to you not like picking up a book and having like consumed the whole thing by touch.
Well, I just finished the Iliad today, so maybe I have justification. I mean, for the 12th time. So maybe I have justification for
not having finished this whole thing. I was trying to give you a backhanded compliment. Now you're just carrying it too far.
So I'm interested to see how she ends up reframing the debate, because a lot of these social concerns were things that I was aware of, but the way that she's showing how the evangelical publications on these issues are so closely tied to the political movements and the political concerns, and not very grounded in theology. So the scriptures come in as support to a pre-existing social argument far more than approaching it to see what the scripture says in context, how that's been understood historically throughout the thousands of years, 2,000 years of church history, and how that should frame our perspective on it. The thing that I found most interesting so far is her conversation about how women's rights did not get off the ground. It was women's responsibilities that got off the ground because Christian women did not support the women's rights movement when it was all about acknowledge my individuality, acknowledge my independence as a person. They got on board with the women's vote when it was women voting can influence society for the better. That was what sold it, which is really interesting because I had not ever heard it framed that way before.
So just going from my shooting from the hip here.
That's okay. I haven't finished the book. So.
That seems like that would be consistent though. Also with other movements as well.
What do you mean?
That often things don't get done when people are just talking about like, hey, this is how it ought to be.
Right.
There has to be a pragmatic application. Like, this is how it ought to be. And by the way, it's really good for everybody. So let's do
right,
it.
Right.
So
not just ideally. You should have these rights accorded to you,
right.
But you should seek these rights in order to seek this good.
Right. Idealism usually is kind of held in the halls of academia, but it doesn't get practically applied till there's a pragmatic
call. Yeah.
So
anyway,
I'll be interested to hear because this is one of those debates that I'm really uncomfortable with because on the one hand, there are some things that I think are pretty clearly theologically lend themselves to the complementarian position.
Right.
The created order, the way that everything in the New Testament kind of runs from, you know, husband, then wife, and then you have things like you have disciples, you have predominantly men in a lot of the primary roles. But then there's those exceptions in the New Testament that you're like, oh, wait a minute, who's this gal that Paul is writing to as a significant member of the Roman Church? And
right.
Is she an apostle, or is she what is she? I think it's Junia,
mm-hmm.
And then you have Martha and Mary, and Mary is at Jesus's feet, and that's supposed to be a place like a lot of people, like when I read that as a kid, I was like, oh yeah, whatever, she's at his feet, she's learning from Jesus, but like that was reserved for men only. So
right.
Martha's that's response, her,
she's in seminary.
She's clearly in a position that's reserved, like she has stepped outside of the cultural norms.
Right.
So there's stuff like that I see in the New Testament. So I understand, some of the groundwork for the egalitarian argument. So it's a conversation that I'd be interested to read it myself.
I think again, I don't know where the book's going to go, but I think for me, one of the things that you were talking about labels not being that helpful when personally applied, but even theologically, like the complementarian position versus mm-hmm. the egalitarian position.
Mm-hmm.
When I think clearly principles that are espoused by both, not the entire frameworks, of course,
mm-hmm.
clearly some of those principles can coexist. And there is a lot that cannot, but there is clear scriptural support for there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, slave nor free,
yeah.
Which clearly offers something that is supposed to inform our understanding of our relationships to one another. But at the exact same time, there is clearly stuff that is undeniably hierarchical.
Right.
And
God is always spoken of as a father.
Yes.
It's in
always.
Gendered terms. Right.
But there is imagery in the Old Testament that speaks of him in feminine terms, not in any way that we could be, I couldn't be comfortable.
But predominantly, it's,
yes,
it's gendered male.
Yes. And of course, Jesus came as a man, and Jesus,
the bride is the church.
Yes.
Christ is cast as,
right.
Right. Right.
So with all of that, for me, it relates to my understanding of, free will and predestination, two things that are classically opposed to one another in theological debates, and two systems of thought that are not entirely compatible, but two positions which are elements of which are
tension to some extent.
Whether they're clearly both supported in some respect by Scripture, and I don't think you can deny either reality. How you reconcile
them? You can't deny. Because there are entire groups of people who do.
Can deny that
yes.
that will is a thing. And yet all this teaching in Scripture that talks about our choices and that we make them, mm-hmm. as that clearly we make choices.
Right.
And
right.
clearly
and
God is sovereign.
On both sides of that argument.
I know.
I've tried to play the other side at points, and it's pretty tough to play like a hardcore 100% free will position.
I think it's impossible. But I think it's equally impossible to deny
right,
it. And
right.
yet some people do the impossible. I don't know.
So really the middle ground of there are, like you say, there's a tension between the two. There's a way to treat both of these, in a way they both are reality in a way that we probably can't even quite understand.
Not quite fully understand. Not that we should give up the effort to clarify, but I do think that something like this book that's attempting to kind of clear away some probably ill-founded assumptions and give us a new starting ground to try to actually have the debate on terms that are more productive is really good. I wouldn't want us to stop debating and trying to come to the truth. But I do think that acknowledging that there are some things that are apparently contradictory and totally denying one of them does not do anything to bring us closer to the truth.
Hmm. Interesting. Interesting. I think the thing, again, it's funny how the theme of this, like our last however many minutes of conversation has been like, how do we argue?
Right.
How, what's the appropriate way to have a disagreement? And I think that that is a skill that we've lost in general.
Culturally?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I think so.
Just look at Facebook for half a second and you'll be like, oh my word. I won't even engage with folks on Facebook because if you're not, there's not even a starting point to have a conversation from.
Right.
Well, what did we just talk about? The we all agreed that trust is the number one thing you have to be able to have.
Yeah.
If you don't have trust, there's no way to get there. And how deep of a deep trust relationship do you have with your Aunt Gladys?
Have you seen the studies that are saying that Americans distrust each other at levels that are comparable to like massive disruptive movements like it's something like, and I'm going to butcher this. This is a study that was conducted by Abraham Lincoln last year.
And we found it on the internet.
And now I'm quoting it from memory. So good luck on any of this being accurate, but it was something along the lines that if you ask Republicans, if they think Democrats want what's like are intentionally trying to destroy the country, they say yes,
which is insane
at a like a very high percentage, like more than 50%, and then vice versa it's true as well that Democrats believe that Republicans like want to undo the nation at very, very high levels,
and there's no place to go from there.
There's no trust.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to build consensus if you believe that the other person standing in opposition to you is not working towards the same goal. But I would say this. I trust you guys, like that whole little soliloquy I did earlier about pursuing the same king.
Right.
But that is one thing that has become problematic nationally is we have a lot of conflicting values right now, and we're not pursuing the same things. Right. So it kind of makes sense.
It does kind of make sense, because when I think about the people I trust, it does tend to be the people that fall into that group of people I know are
safe,
pursuing the same thing that I'm pursuing, even if, yeah, safe. That, but the key characteristic of people I trust are people that I know well, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's the people I've known for a long time. It's the people I talk to on a regular basis. It's the people I interact with on different levels, at several different levels in different arenas of life. Like, it's not like just some random person who also claims to be a Christian I'm going to have that trust relationship with.
Have you guys ever experienced this, where you have like a really significant trust relationship with a person who believes radically different from you? Like politically, ethically, have you ever had that experience?
I don't know how radically we can go, because I do have one really good friend from graduate school who is an atheist, extremely liberal politically, mm-hmm. A CrossFitter. I mean, seriously, who can? No.
What does that have to do? And here we're back to labels. Okay. Defining people
but
by their labels. Yep.
Absolutely someone I would trust in a personal crisis. Someone, yeah, I would trust.
Exactly.
You know, with my children.
Right.
Just.
Right. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But those are really important.
But how many of us have a broad enough social circle that we actually interact with people that we disagree with on a regular basis?
Well, I think we all do. Most of us do. But a lot of those kinds of people, we just don't give space.
Or don't work on cultivating
that
relationship.
Don't engage with at that deep level.
Right.
Because we don't trust them.
Right.
Or and because it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. Or potentially harmful.
Yeah.
Like to
well, before this friend and I became good friends, we had to argue a lot in classes in graduate school on opposite sides of big debates.
Everything.
Everything.
You,
it was ridiculous.
I'm assuming you typically taking a more conservative position and then
well,
taking
yes.
a more
yes.
liberal position. And then
and we had our first knockdown, drag-out fights in a post-colonial literature class, arguing about imperialism and and big fights about absolute truth and whether or not you can impose morality on other people or not.
You always impose morality on other people.
Well, this would be the position I took, but
yeah.
It was, I mean,
yeah.
Other people in the room stressed out about it and ending up
saying
being,
that racism is wrong, which it is.
Is imposing
morality,
morality
on other people.
Yes.
Bigot.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Saying that women have value is imposing morality on, yeah.
Yeah. So we were arguing about, I don't know if I can say this on the female genital mutilation, which is a practice.
Why couldn't you say that?
I don't know. It's,
it's a,
people
it's a
get
thing.
Skeeved out by that. It, far more than
what
saying.
What word did you just use?
Female genital mutilation.
No. I'm
oh,
glad
say
you
it
repeated
again,
that
say
too.
It again.
But I was
louder now.
People get
skeeved.
Skeeved. How do you spell that?
Skeeved.
Ooh, let's see what.
Skeeved. What is
that? I want you to.
I'm scared of Urban Dictionary now.
Hashtag skeeved on Twitter and see what comes up.
So let's see what.
Remember, I was brought
says.
Up in the wilds of Northern Idaho. My cultural references
are. Oh, I thought this was like a really, really hip. Like you've been.
Oh, I don't think that's hip.
All these 16, 17-year-olds.
16 and 17-year-olds are.
Skeeved me out when he ate the gummy bear off the floor in the movie theater.
that's
the first a good thing example that came sentence.
Up. What else you got on there? That was fantastic.
20-year-old guys who date girls too young to drive really skeeve me out.
Okay, so back to your comment about...
yes.
So you had an argument about...
We had an argument about
it.
Imposing our morality
yeah.
on tribes people in the Sudan who practice female genital mutilation as a component of their tribal and religious culture. Mm-hmm. And
whether that's quote unquote right or wrong.
Well, that's eventually we agreed that it was wrong, and eventually I think we got to the point where we agreed it was okay to impose our morality on them and make that illegal, and forcibly stop them from doing that. But
doesn't
but that's where we had to get before we could.
Doesn't everything come down to absolute truth?
Kind of lost track of my conversation. Come back to.
Is it all about you, John? Are you sure?
This part of the conversation was about whether or not you have people in your life that you can trust.
Yes.
Don't.
It's all about.
So this person,
John,
is someone that you would trust with your kids in a pinch, or if you had a personal emergency, if you called them up, you think that they would be trustworthy.
I would trust them with a personal dilemma.
Right.
I had this same relationship.
Melissa and I were newlyweds. We had Ethan, I think, at the time. And there was two people that I worked with on the night shift, who I talked with every night. We debated politics. We talked about all kinds of crazy stuff. And they didn't see eye to eye on everything, but they both took very different. One of them was like an ex-biker, and he was a truck driver, real salty. He was the modern equivalent of a sailor. And on every level, down to the beard and the long hair, it looked like a pirate a little bit. And and the other gal was she did admin in the office, and we had these long knockdown drag out debates, and everything was cool. Like they were open to having conversations about religion. I mean, it was all on the table, like, mm-hmm. and they would intentionally try to bring stuff up to embarrass me, and it was a great relationship. And I remember telling Melissa at one point, like, I trust these people. These are friends. Right. These are people who, like, if we were in an emergency, we could take Ethan to their house. And she's like, what? the pirate? Like, really? and that those kinds of relationships are becoming fewer and farther in between.
I think these kinds of relationships are becoming fewer and farther between, because we all see everyone's opinions on all kinds of minutiae and get wound up about it and bent out of shape about it and don't actually have the conversations. I have a feeling that David and I probably disagree on take a knee. Probably.
I don't think David cares enough.
Does David care enough?
I don't think David cares.
I think it's the dumbest thing. Like, it's not that important. Just find some
as a controversy
to argue about.
Okay.
Yeah, as a controversy.
Okay, so maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. We definitely disagree over whether or not The Hobbit should have been made into a movie.
We could probably disagree. We could probably.
I don't think David would disagree on whether The Hobbit is a good movie. I think.
Yeah.
He better not try to defend that. Rabbit drawn sledge. But I know
that was horrible.
I want to say it's the worst, but there are so many other candidates for that position. The sandworms from Dune showing up at the Battle of Five Armies. That is the worst.
How about the hobbits and the elf romance? I mean,
that's the worst.
Fabulous.
That is also the worst. Okay. My ranking system is broken. anyway, because people see the disagreement and don't address it in the context of the relationship, they'd fail to get close to people. I think I know I have not gotten close to people, partly because of I've already seen our disagreements online, where so the kind of argumentative conflict for the sake of learning type of relationship that we've all managed to build over the years might not work so much when we're all exposed to each other's opinions on all kinds of little things online all day, every day, instead of living in community together.
That's a great point. So if I'm sitting here on Facebook and I see Amanda posting all about how dumb this, or how it's absolutely great that these players are standing up and are kneeling and, whatever. And I have the opposite opinion. And I'm thinking, well, I don't want to go challenge her on that because
you don't know me very well.
I don't know her that well, and we obviously don't agree, so she's probably not my kind of person.
Right.
And
stupid liberal feminist.
Yeah.
Is there anything handy to throw?
You've got coffee over there.
I do.
I'd start with the coffee.
That's probably not a good idea.
Are you feeling skeeved out?
A little skeeved out here.
Oh, my word.
So then what, how,
So how does our,
What did you really want to say there, Amanda? I'm curious now.
Well, I wanted to ask a question, and then it seemed really trite, and then I was trying to think about why I wanted to ask it, so I tied myself up in a question. So how do we build relationships in a world of total connectivity? How do we actually build community?
Okay, so I think there's lots of people thinking about talking about and writing about this and
smarter than us. Yeah.
And I'm going to make the simplest statement on the planet on the topic. Eat together.
Ooh.
I can support that.
I did not expect that.
We don't eat enough food together at another person's table.
I think we eat plenty of food.
There is an intimacy of there is an intimacy that we share over food that we have lost the art form of. And when you go to a foreign country, the hospitality that is expressed in food or in beverage, when you show up at somebody's house from another country, either here, who's moved here, or if you have ever traveled overseas, you'll find that hospitality and food are linked in a way that we have completely lost the context.
And
of.
You say we as in American culture.
I'm going to wax biographical here
because that is what, I mean, I've really enjoyed and hope we continue to sit around here with microphones in our faces. But the reason that the three of us are friends is because the six of us are friends and the 12 kids are friends. And the reason that the six of us are friends and the 12 kids are friends is because we have gathered again and again and again around a dining table,
right,
around a picnic table, around a pot of soup, around some pizza and
birthday cake.
Yep.
And that is sharing life together.
And the thing is that all the shaping moments that I can identify in, and I probably think about this far more than you do because I'm a girl and that's what girls do, but all the shaping moments in our friendship, I can tie back to times that we've been eating together.
Times at a table. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or talking about times that we've eaten together. I know that I felt my relationship with your wife, John, totally affirmed in a moment when I expressed an insecurity to her and she talked about all of the times that we had literally broken bread together. She talked about how what she associated in her mind with coming to my house was not my insecurities about my house, its size, its condition.
Right.
It was homemade bread that we ate together and enough food for all of the kids.
Wait. You make homemade bread?
Yes.
Just doesn't fit my labels for you.
Whoops.
Okay, continue. Sorry.
And I know that one of the earliest bonding moments I had with your wife, David, was over our shared need to be fed when we go to each other's houses, about how we had both shared these other experiences where we had visited someone's house and not even been offered a glass of water,
right,
and how nothing against that person. That was a very nice person, but you just don't feel
Let's
welcome.
Let's step Donnybrook over that. Yes, something against that person. Shame on them.
Okay, shame on them.
Shame on them. That, like, this is something that we have lost the art of. I
sympathize with people who have not been taught or trained. Like, I was raised that to know that when someone comes over, you give them food, you invite people over after church. I was taught and trained.
But that's like saying I sympathize with somebody who was never taught to not pass gas in public. Like, this is a basic skill set.
Wait. What is the social norm I never heard of before?
This is a basic skill set that we have lost. I think it's that critical and that important that we would have the ability to say, somebody shows up at our house, can I put on a cup of, or, you know, a pot of coffee? Do we have jam and bread? Like, it doesn't have to be fancy.
Right.
That we can just break together.
And that's what Melissa has encouraged me in. It doesn't have to be fancy. I don't have to perform in serving dinner.
Right.
And that was really good. That's been really good for me to have that encouragement from somebody who appreciates the finer things in life too, to affirm that it doesn't have to be the finer things in life. We can just get together around whatever we can put together.
Whatever we can throw together.
Right.
And
but I know I have kitchen. I some of the situations in my life, I'm trying to be appropriately vague here, where it has been hard to connect with people. One of the key things has been I have invited people to my house and not been invited to their house. And that not having a reciprocating fellowship going back and forth to people's houses has made it harder, much harder to build a relationship, even where I wanted to build one. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is. It's a huge cultural failing.
I love that. I think it is so wonderful to see people in their household. I don't care if it's messy. It's so wonderful. And I feel like you get such
I kind of care.
Greater sense of who the people are and the way they live, and you just get this real connection to them by seeing them in their house. I think
well, and the intimacy of conversation just goes up the longer the meal goes. You get the kids busy playing Legos or sit them down in front of a movie or something so they can be quiet for 5 minutes, and then
it takes a while for inhibitions for you to get over your own inhibitions. And a lot of people manufacture the inhibitions delay by consuming copious amounts of alcohol so that they can have that same sense of
relaxed.
Yeah. Of community or whatever.
Right.
But for that to have a genuine closeness or for hospitality to really work, it takes time.
That's really interesting that you
so
talk
eat
that
food
about
and take time.
Right. Because the taking time and the eating food are those key components.
So what do we take from this? Find people in your life
that you can disagree with but not attach labels to.
And trust.
And have homemade bread.
And work ski
at Amanda's
into
house.
Every conversation.
Well, I don't know. I was actually just looking at the definition more. It says to gross out, to disgust, to make your skin crawl, sometimes with undertones of sexual deviance, perversion. So, you know.
Is that part of your homeschool upbringing? Is that what?
All righty. Well, John, can you take us out of here with a random song of the week?
This is Lost Ageless by St. Vincent, and this gal has a voice that reminds me of a band called Fleming and John that I loved in the 90s. They had a really weird album that...
In love stages, yeah, the wind that never comes. In love stages, the mothers milk their young.
Ooh, I'm digging this music.
Is it fast enough for you?
Nope.
All right.
I like it. That's pretty fun stuff.
Okay. It's off.
All righty. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in for episode 6. And hopefully we entertained you. Hopefully we came to a interesting conclusion.
Eat more food.
Eat more food. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time. I'm David.
I'm Amanda.
And I'm Skeeved.